What's up, you guys? I'm Andrea.
And I'm Haley.
And you're listening to Inhuman, a true crime podcast.
My baby waking up from his nap as soon as we start to record.
In true baby fashion. All right. Well, welcome back, everybody. Thank you for being here. Today, I'm going to be discussing the chilling disappearances of the Yuba County Five.
I don't think I know anything about this.
Okay. So I researched the case and then I was like, oh, let me see if anybody suggested it. And boy, did they. So I just want to give a shout out to Key, Megan, Oscar, Taylor, Lance, as well as several others for suggesting this case. I did know it. I was familiar with most of the details. And it is a really, really sad and tragic case. So
okay. Wow.
Get ready. Yeah.
All right.
On February 24th, 1978, five young men from Yuba County, California, attended a college basketball game at Chico State, which is a CSU campus in Chico, California.
Yep.
And this was about 50 miles away from their hometowns. The five men, 29-year-old Bill Sterling, 24-year-old Jack Hewitt, 32-year-old Ted Weir, 30-year-old Jack Madruga, and 25-year-old Gary Mathias, all struggled with unspecified intellectual, physical, and mental disabilities, and they were each part of a special education project.
Okay.
As a result, the boys, which they are often referred to by their families and the media, became a very close-knit group of friends. Which I think is just so sweet and precious.
Yeah, that is really sweet.
Yeah.
Like, they all were a part of, like, this special education program, and they all kind of, like, became one big family.
Yeah.
Aw, I love that.
So, not only that, but they were each huge fans of the visiting team from the University of California, Davis, who ended up winning the game that night.
Oh, wow. I love UC Davis. I applied there, and... like, if I was going to stay in California for college, that's where I would have gone. It's like Aww. A beautiful campus. It's really cool. So I love that.
Yeah. Well, they were huge fans of their basketball team. So, and Aww. They were very excited that they won that night.
That's awesome.
Around 10 p.m. after the game concluded, the boys were spotted at a convenience store called Bear's Market, and they were grabbing snacks for their trek back to Yuba. In Jack's 1969 Mercury Montego.
Love it.
Around 2 a.m., Juanita Sterling, Bill's mother, woke up out of a deep sleep to find that her son had not yet returned home.
Oh, gosh.
Instantly, she discerned that something was wrong. So Juanita called Jack Madruga's mother, Mabel, and she, too, confirmed that Jack had also not come home. Around 5 a.m., Ted's mother, Imogen, awoke to find her son's bed empty and intact.
Oh, my God.
Imogen sent her daughter-in-law down the street to Gary's house to check with his family as she called Jack Hewitt's mother, Sarah, and soon their worst fears were realized. None of the boys had come home that night.
Oh, that is so terrifying.
I know, it is. And it's like... your child is missing. I mean, your child is missing nonetheless, like your adult yeah. child is missing, but they're, you know, for at least four of the boys, they were very childlike mentally in a lot of ways. Right. So it's just like your little baby is missing. That's how I felt. And like, that's how I took it.
Yeah. And that must have been so terrifying. Like with each one, they're probably hoping like, oh, maybe they're all at so-and-so's house. Okay, they're yeah. not there. Maybe they're all at the next person's house. And like with each one, you probably, the panic just like
sets got worse and worse. And yeah. So their parents were obviously very concerned because not only was this completely out of character for the young men, but they also had a very important commitment the following day. So not only did the boys attend the Yuba City Vocational Rehabilitation Center together, which was a special education program, but they also played basketball for the center's team, the Gateway Gators. And they were scheduled to participate in a tournament hosted by the Special Olympics in Sacramento. Oh, wow. And they were all like super excited about it. Like, it was so cute. One of the parents said that her son kept reminding her, like, don't let me oversleep. Like, make sure my alarm's set. Like, you know, make sure I don't oversleep. All excited.
They were clearly very excited.
Very excited. So they wouldn't purposely miss it.
Right.
Mabel, which was Jack M's mother, I'll kind of refer to him as Jack M and then Jack H, like, throughout the course of the story, to try to keep them straight. So Mabel, which was Jack M's mother, called the police to notify them that all five young men were missing, and a search for them followed. Police searched from Yuba County to Chico with no luck. It did not help that there was a substantial amount of snow on the ground at this time. So it made their search difficult, to say the least. But then a few days later, on February 28th, in a remote area of the Plumas National Forest, a U.S. Forest Service ranger spotted Jax Mercury Montego.
No.
Yeah. The Montego was located on a high mountain dirt road at the base of a snowbank, apparently stuck. However, upon further investigation, investigators discovered that the vehicle was not stuck at all.
Oh, gosh.
It had apparently spun out, but the five young men could have easily pushed the car back onto the roadway. The vehicle also had a full tank of gas and no obvious damage. Inside, the police found the remnants of the snacks the boys had picked up from the convenience store, as well as several maps. So, the location of the vehicle right away did not make sense to police because it was a remote road and it was 70 miles in the opposite direction from the route the young men should have been traveling back that night.
Okay, so it's almost like somebody tried to make it look like it had like spun out and like gotten into an accident, but
maybe
none of it makes sense because they're in the wrong direction.
It could definitely be that or something along those lines, because it just didn't make sense why they were where they were, because even if they took a wrong turn, at some point you would think
that far.
Yeah, 70 miles is like really far. And I'll share a map of this whole area, like the location the car was found, where they were headed to and where they were coming from, so you can get a better idea of where the car was located in reference to where they should have been headed.
Okay.
So police, of course, began searching the surrounding area for any sign of the boys, but not a single trace was found. Again, it did not help that there was a merciless winter storm occurring. So unfortunately, their search was paused until the weather could calm down a little bit.
I feel like it's kind of like I'm imagining like the type of storm that's going through the U.S. right now, where there's just like lots of snow, really cold temperatures, like you just can't do anything.
Right. And I will share a picture. There was a picture in one of the articles that showed like how the snow was at that time. It's, you know, grainy, pixelated because it's from like the 70s, but I'm still going to share it so you can get an idea of like how rough this terrain was.
Okay.
The families of the missing young men offered a reward of $1,215 for any information that led to their discovery, and their story was broadcasted widely in the Yuba and Chico County areas, and police did receive tons of tips. They received dozens upon dozens of tips, but it didn't really lead anywhere.
Okay.
But then a witness came forward with a strange tale, to say the least. 55-year-old Joseph Shones went to the Yuba County Police claiming he had been driving up near Bucks Lake to check on his cabin when his Volkswagen Beetle became stuck in the snowbank. Shones unfortunately suffered a heart attack while attempting to free his car, but he managed to collapse back into the vehicle. And several hours later, a car pulled up behind his with their headlights blaring. He stated that several men and a woman holding a baby got out of the car and were talking.
Okay.
Sean said, I know, I was like, what? Sean said he called out for help and the group silenced themselves and turned off their headlights.
Ooh, okay.
Then he fell asleep and awoke 2 hours later to flashlights beaming outside his window. Again, he called out for help and the lights went out. Very bizarre.
That's very, like, ominous.
Ominous. Like. Yeah, it is. Yeah. The following morning, Shones decided he was well enough to attempt walking down the mountain for help. And as he stepped out of his vehicle, he saw the Mercury Montego, where he had seen the group of men the night before. So Ted's mother would later say ignoring someone's pleas for help was not like her son at all, if that was truly him there with the group of men and the woman and the baby.
Okay.
She recalled how Ted and Bill had once helped someone who had been overdosing on Valium get to the hospital. So she kind of didn't really believe that her son was there, if it was the group of boys.
Right.
But because based on that, she was like, there's no way he would just turn off the headlights.
He would do that, right.
Go silent, which is just weird for anybody to do, honestly.
Yeah. It's it's suspicious, like, what was going on that they, like, didn't want to be seen, whoever it was.
Right, right. And it's like, I have to remind myself that, you know, they do have struggles and they may not think of things logically like we would. So maybe they were scared. If it was them, like, maybe they were scared and they got freaked out, so they just, like, turned the lights out.
Yeah.
But if they were also, like, stuck and needed help, you would think that maybe they would.
They wouldn't do that.
Yeah. So it's just a really weird story. And obviously police were unable to confirm the story, but it is interesting. So I wanted to share it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it may have been them based on what we're going to learn.
Interesting.
Coming
okay.
up. Then another tip came in from a woman who worked in Brownsville, which was about 30 miles away from where the vehicle was discovered. And this woman claimed that she saw the five boys and they had stopped at Mary's County store in a red pickup truck around 2 p.m. the day after they disappeared.
Okay.
And the interesting thing is that the store owner corroborated her account. And Lieutenant Dennis Moore of the Yuba County Police Department stated he believed that she was a credible witness, but unfortunately, neither eyewitness accounts brought forth the location of the boys, and their case goes cold. And it's like, okay, maybe it was them. Maybe they caught a ride from somebody in a red truck, but where was that person?
Right.
You know?
Like, that person isn't just going to, like, be gone.
Here's my truck. See you later. I'll stay out here in the cold snow and freeze to death, you know?
Yeah,
it's so bizarre. Again, another bizarre account, but she was deemed credible, so.
Interesting.
Very interesting. And unfortunately, it would be several months before any movement would happen in the case, and regrettably, the news was not good. According to the Washington Post, on June 4th, a small group of Sunday motorcyclists strayed into an abandoned Forest Service trailer camp over 19 miles from where the vehicle the boys were traveling in was found.
19 miles?
Yeah. 19 miles. Yeah. In the snow.
In the snow. Oh, my God.
The group began to slowly notice a foul odor permeating from one of the trailers. They decided to investigate the smell, and they made a gruesome discovery. And it's rough, so just...
Oh, God. Okay.
Inside the trailer, on the bed, was the decomposing body of Ted Weir. He was found with 8 sheets pulled over his body and tucked around his head. His shoes were missing, and on a table by the bed were his ring with his first name engraved on it, his gold necklace, his wallet with money still inside, and a gold watch, which the families would later say did not belong to any of the boys.
Okay.
Ted, who was around 200 pounds at the time of his disappearance, was now much smaller.
Oh my God.
He had lost about 80 to 100 pounds, leading police to think that he lived anywhere from 8 to 13 weeks inside the trailer, starving to death.
Oh my God.
Ted's feet were badly frostbitten, and he had grown a long beard, which further proved their theory. Absolutely awful. Oh my
God.
Absolutely awful.
And also, this is like kind of sounding more familiar now. I feel like I remember
this detail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That is horrific.
I
like,
know.
Like, already finding your child like that, you know, is going to, like, finding your child no longer alive is not going to be good. But then knowing from the state of their body that they likely suffered
immensely. Yeah. Ugh.
Like, starvation death is not, is like, I feel like deaths like that, that are like prolonged, like starvation or dying of like thirst or frostbite or whatever.
Yeah.
That's like a million times worse, I feel like.
I know. Upon further investigation, police discovered the trailer had been broken into through a window, and more than a dozen combat ration cans from an outside storage shed had been opened and emptied. And one had been opened with an Army P-38 can opener, which police kind of decided that only Gary or Jack, who had both served in the Army, probably knew how to operate.
So far they've only found Ted.
Correct.
Okay. But there's like signs that at least more than one of the other boys were likely there.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there was another locker in the same storage shed that contained enough dehydrated dinners, fruit cocktails, and other assorted meals to keep all 5 men alive for a year. But no one had opened that locker.
Oh my God.
I know. And it's like they had to have known that it was there. But again, I think some of the boys would not think about it rationally in that way. Like, this is food. We need to eat it to survive. And I saw in one source that I used that they may have been like felt guilty because it wasn't theirs. And so they didn't want to quote unquote steal it.
Oh my God.
And just not having that like know-it-all to
that
they needed it to survive.
Stealing because you're literally trying to survive.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So with that, it also appeared that no fire had ever been built, despite there being matches and wooden furniture in the trailer. The day after Ted's body was found, searchers found the remains of Jack and Bill.
Oh gosh.
Their bodies were discovered on opposite sides of the road leading up to the trailer, 11.4 miles from the car.
Oh my gosh.
Jack's remains had been dragged to a stream by animals about 10 feet away. He was lying face up, and in his right hand, he was clutching his watch. Mm. Bill's remains, which were nothing but bones by this point, were found in a wooded area scattered over about 50 feet. 2 days later, Jack Hewitt's remains were found. And this is gut-wrenching. His father, who had joined in on the search against the better judgment of Lieutenant Lance Ayers of the Yuba Police Department, who was also heavily invested in the case for years and years and years and years. So Jack Hewitt's father actually discovered the partial remains of his own son.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh.
I know.
And the fact that they were so far from the car, like,
it's so bizarre. It really is.
Oh, wow.
Along with the few bones they found in that location, they discovered Jack's Levi's and his shoes. And the next day, his skull was found, and it was confirmed to be Jack's by dental records. It was later determined that all four men died of hypothermia.
Wow. That was their cause of death?
Yeah. And it's like, God, I just like have so many questions, and I just like, the more the story unfolds, the more questions you have.
Yeah, it's like, were they...
It's like, why were they not all in the trailer?
Right, like, did they...
And if they ventured out, like, say, two of them ventured out, or maybe even three of them ventured out to try to get help, why were they... And, you know, of course, animals could have drug and scattered their bodies, but it's like, why were they in all these different locations instead of, like, right there beside each other, right. You know?
And how did they get there? Why didn't they open the shed? Why didn't they? Yeah, there's just so many questions.
And then the biggest question is, where was Gary?
Yeah.
There was absolutely no sign of Gary aside from his shoes. So he was wearing tennis shoes that night, and all the boys had on like lightweight jackets because obviously they were just going to a basketball game and weren't planning to hike 20 miles in the snow.
Yeah.
So his shoes were found inside the trailer where Ted was discovered. And police kind of theorized that maybe he took his shoes off and then put Ted's shoes on because his were missing, because he was wearing boots that night. And maybe he thought...
Also, like, make it easier to...
Trek through the snow.
Right.
Which makes tons of sense to me. But again, it's like, where is he? If all four boys but Ted left the trailer to go get help... Again, why were they not all found together?
Right.
It's just so odd.
So bizarre.
Now, some of you might be thinking, and the thought did cross my mind too, could Gary have done something that caused this? Because he was diagnosed with schizophrenia. Now, obviously, schizophrenia does not cause you to hurt others. But Gary, unfortunately, did have a history of violence and psychosis. But according to his family, he had been taking his medication regularly for the last 2 years, and he had not had any psychotic episodes since he had been on his meds.
I wonder if he was off his meds because they were obviously not planning to be gone. So maybe he got off of his meds and then, like... That's what could have happened, but they died from hypothermia. It's not like they died from
being murdered.
Yeah. Right. Like they weren't strangled. They weren't stabbed. They weren't, you know, so as much as I say like, oh, maybe that could be the case, it also doesn't really seem like that.
It doesn't add up to me either. Like, he was doing really well. Like, he was working a steady job at his stepfather's business. He was taking his medication so faithfully that his doctor referred to him as, quote, one of their sterling success cases. So he just, he was doing well. So there's no real reason to think that he did anything to cause this necessarily. But of the five men, Gary was kind of the leader of the group, if you will. And I would think that if he was there, he would have been like, let's build a fire. Let's eat this food. You know, he would have brought forth these ideas to help them survive. So
interesting.
It just, none of it adds up. And like, if he was off of his meds after weeks and weeks and weeks, obviously, of them being there trying to survive, he wasn't off his meds the night that they disappeared and ended up on that mountain. So what happened between the game and that for this to occur? So along with all this, Gary also had a wonderful relationship with his family. He loved playing basketball with the other four young men, and he seemed happy and well-equipped for his life post-Army. To this day, Gary or his remains have never been found.
Wow. But also, it had been so long, bad, you know, condition. So maybe like an animal had got, maybe an animal had gotten him and like, you know, dispersed the remains so much that he just wasn't able to be found.
And that's a theory too, that he likely died on that mountain with the other four boys and they just were unable to, because of the conditions, find his remains, which is so sad.
Yeah, that is so sad, because it's like he, you know, all the other families at least got to have like that 100% closure and lay their bodies to rest. And that's just sad that his family wasn't even able to have that.
I know. And it is. It's so awful.
You know, obviously we don't know what happened, but having that suspicion, even if it's, you know, people, you know, who knows who's casting that suspicion that like maybe he could have potentially been involved, but just having that too,
I know,
I feel like just it would make it so much harder. But there was just no indication that he did anything.
No.
So I really don't
think none at
that
all
that would be, that doesn't have any like credibility in my eyes.
I agree.
But there's still,
like, it seemed like he loved those boys, you know, like he kind of took them under his wing in a way.
Yeah. And even if you look at it completely objectively, like they died from hypothermia. They didn't die from, like I said, they didn't die from being murdered. And there's just no evidence that points to that. But the fact that he was never found, I'm sure there's still people who are like, oh, maybe he's out there, like,
yeah, you
know, hiding away or whatever. It's like, and so I'm sure that that makes it even harder for his family too.
Yeah, I know. Think about the families when you're spreading misinformation like that.
Truly.
So thousands of leads continued to pour into the Yuba County Police Department, and police investigated every single plausible one. There are still so many questions that remain in this case, and the theories are obviously abundant.
Mm-hmm.
Their family knew these young men were tough, resilient, and resourceful despite their struggles mentally, intellectually, or physically. And it just does not add up to them. One, why the boys were up in the mountains to begin with. Two, why they left a perfectly operable vehicle to walk 20 miles in the snow to the trailer. Three, why they didn't make a fire, which they knew at least Gary and Jack H. could have easily done because they were both Army vets. Four, why they didn't eat the remaining food from the storage shed. And five, why was Ted the only person found in the trailer?
Yeah, there's it literally like none of it makes sense. It's not, it doesn't point to, oh, they all, I don't know, for some reason thought the car didn't work, so they were going to try to hike to safety. Why'd they go up into the mountains? And then why weren't they all in the trailer? Okay, maybe they went to get help, but they still had resources. And like, why would they leave one person behind in the trailer?
Right. That's the thing. That's the thing I get caught up on is, like, even if he, let's say, like, he was the worst off physically as far as, like, the frostbite and he couldn't walk and the other four could, you would think they would have at least left one person with him.
Unless maybe two people left and then didn't come back. So then two more people, the other two left. Like,
yeah.
Or I wonder if, like, he died on the mountain and then they like carried him.
Yeah, but he had the beard and the weight loss and all that stuff.
That's
so
that's true.
That to me says he had been alive for a while.
Yeah. And they weren't able to tell from the other remains like what state their bodies were in, right? Because it was kind of just like bones.
Yeah, it was mostly bones. I mean, one of the boys was found, I guess he was more intact than the others because they found him like clutching his watch.
Right.
But yeah, all the other two boys were just skeletal remains at that point.
So they weren't able to tell like the state that their bodies were in the sense of like how long,
knowing how long
they had been.
Yeah, exactly. They just, there just was nothing, unfortunately.
Wow.
And I do want to note that, so the Forest Service Rangers had snowplowed the road down the mountain. So they would have had a pretty clear path to walk. But like you said, why walk up the mountain and not down the mountain?
Right. That just doesn't, like, even if they're like, oh, shoot, we think our car is stuck and we can't get out and we need to go find help. Why would they walk up the mountain?
Right. So the only thing that makes sense to the families is that somebody made them do this. But who and how could they have made 5 grown men do anything? I mean,
I guess if they had a shot, like if they had a gun or something.
Yeah, that's true. They might have
been too scared and not like thought that they had the ability to overpower.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, that is a possibility. I mean, it definitely is because, you know, they just didn't think like we do necessarily about certain things.
And even like, even if they did, I feel like if somebody has like a gun and is threatening you with a gun, no matter how many of you there are, like, it's still scary to think like,
yeah, I'm not trying to take somebody down with a gun. I mean, yeah. But my husband, on the other hand, I think he would.
Yeah, that's probably true.
If he was by himself, he probably would.
Right. But you just don't know. And then why did they die from hypothermia? If they, unless the person like forced them up there and then abandoned them. But like, what was the motive? That makes zero sense.
That's what I know, because there is a theory of that too. Like maybe someone who knew that they were, you know, intellectually handicapped, and so they forced them up there to have them
die.
Like, which is like, why? Like, why would you do that? That's
why
awful.
Didn't
like,
you murder them in a different way? Like, why you just like leave them there to start? Right. Like, that doesn't make sense. There's just no motive.
Natural causes. Yeah, yeah. And then the question of the alleged sighting from Sholmes.
Right. That was considered credible.
Yeah. Did he really see 5 men that night? And if so, who was the woman and the baby? Because police were never able to track down that woman and her baby.
I err on the side of like, that was not like a super credible account, whether like he thought he saw that.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe he just was seeing things or like didn't know what he saw, and that's what like his brain put together,
like pieced it together, just knowing the story, because by that point he knew the story, what was going on out there, you know.
So it just, I don't know, I err on the side of like that not being accurate, not saying that he lied, but like that just not being what it seemed to be.
And he like suffered even though it was a mild heart attack, he did suffer a heart attack. And I don't know, like maybe your mind plays tricks on you. Your blood's not flowing properly. Things are happening. Yeah. I mean.
Yeah, I just feel like with witness accounts, like there's always so much room for like error.
Error, yeah.
And so, yeah, that's with all the mystery in this case, I feel like that kind of could be explained away as like it was just a witness account.
Right. And then there is this another theory I'm just going to mention too, is so Gary Mathias, he had some friends in Forbestown, which would have technically, I guess, been on the way in the direction that the car was found. And some people believe that Gary never actually attended the basketball game with the boys and that Jack dropped him off with his friends in Forbestown.
And that they were going to pick him up
on the way back to pick him up when disaster struck. But it doesn't really explain why they were up in the mountain, because that would have been way off track for them even going that direction.
Right.
And then if he was with his friends, like, why didn't he come forward? Like, some people think he was, you know, riddled with guilt at the loss of his friends and went into hiding. But I feel like at some point he would have resurfaced, especially given his mental state and like him needing his medication.
Yeah. And like if he was with the friends, like there's no way that nobody came
would come forward. Yeah.
So especially that, like, if they didn't do anything, it was just like, there's no way that like nobody came forward in all those years.
Yeah. I don't believe that theory either. I mean, there's so many theories, like literally there's just piles upon piles of theories. And
yeah, I mean, when there's no answers and it's so like confusing like this, it's just that's what people do, is come up with theories. And I feel so bad for their families that,
I know,
you know, like, okay, they found their children other than Gary, like they were found, but you have no clue what happened and it makes zero sense.
I know, it doesn't. And there's, like I said, there's just so probably more than any other case. Well, I won't say that, but definitely up there with other, you know, as far as unanswered questions and like not having any idea what could have really truly happened.
And I feel like it's different from other cases too, because there was no definite sign of foul play. So there's even a question of, was there foul play or was this like just a very, very tragic accident?
Yeah.
That like, it just doesn't make sense because of, and also I feel like when you go into like start having, you know, hypothermia and starvation and all of that, like your mind goes too. So maybe they just didn't know what they were doing. Maybe they were like trying to walk and then started getting hypothermia,
which causes you to be sleepy. And so maybe they just laid down and went to sleep.
Right. And then maybe by the time they, I mean, it even could have, that could even explain why they were up the mountain a little more, because maybe like they started getting hypothermia and then thought that, oh, this makes sense to go over the mountain. Or, you know, like, I don't know. It just, I feel like there could, that could explain some of the things, but it still is so confusing and there's too many unanswered questions.
So before we wrap up today's case, I just want to share a little about these young men with you, because I don't know, this case, like obviously a lot of cases touch my heart, and like I'm a tenderhearted person, so it doesn't take much, but I just feel like it's important to share about them because they did, you know,
live
under these incredibly mysterious circumstances, and I just want to share about them. Theodore Earl Weir was a brown-eyed, curly-headed, handsome man who was incredibly friendly in a childlike way. For example, he would wave at strangers and he would get upset for hours if they did not wave back. Which reminds me of my little Violet. She does that and she just gets so mad if people don't wave back. His mother, Imogen, stated that he was a very loving person who loved life and loved people. He would often call his buddy Bill on the phone and laugh about silly things he read in the paper or goofy names he would find in the phone book.
Oh my God, that's adorable. I love that.
Before his disappearance, he worked as a janitor and at a snack bar as a clerk. He often went by the nicknames Teddy or Teddy Bear.
Oh.
I know. Jack Charles Hewitt, who often went by Jackie, was a loving young man who had the most beautiful eyes. He lived on a farm with his family where he'd play with his beagle Beau and ride dirt bikes around their property. Though he could not read or write, his mother Sarah said he was happy and a real delight to those around him. Jackie looked up to Ted and was often referred to as his shadow. And Ted was very protective of him.
Aww.
He was greatly loved and cared for by his family, who were also very protective of him due to his disabilities. William Lee Sterling, better known as Bill, was a deeply religious young man. He enjoyed spending hours at the library reading literature. Bill would often share stories about Jesus to patients in mental hospitals to hopefully bring them closer to him. So he would actually visit mental hospitals for this purpose alone.
Oh my gosh. All of these boys are just like such good humans.
I know. They're like bright lights in such a dark world. Bill also spent a lot of time researching at the library about mentally handicapped people. He was especially close with Jack Madruga, and he was loved dearly by his family. Jack Antone Madruga was a high school graduate and Army veteran. Before his disappearance, he had been working as a busboy for Sunsweet Growers, but he had been sadly laid off. Jack's most prized possession was his 1969 Mercury Montego, and he would never allow anyone but himself to drive it.
Sounds like my husband.
Jack was described by his family as an intelligent and sensitive man, but extremely shy in social situations. His favorite TV show was I Love Lucy, and he loved Motown music. He often went by the nickname Doc. Gary Dell Mathias joined the military in the early 1970s. He had been stationed in West Germany, but unfortunately was discharged due to psychiatric issues that were believed to have been caused by a drug habit that he developed while being stationed there. He was also, like I mentioned previously, eventually diagnosed with schizophrenia, but medicated and back home in Yuba, he worked as the lead assistant to his stepfather at his gardening business. Gary was a big fan of the Rolling Stones and had been the lead singer of his own local rock band called The Fifth Shade.
Oh my God, I love that.
At the time of his disappearance, Gary was dating his high school sweetheart, Lisa, and his future was looking incredibly bright.
Oh my God, that's so sad.
I know, it really is. And like,
so that even further makes me think, like, there's no way he was just like with his friends and never came forward, or that he was like involved some way, because like, no, just no.
I don't think that either. I don't either. But that is the chilling disappearance and death of the Yuba County Five.
Wow.
I just really feel for their families. And, you know, I hope that they got peace and closure to some extent, even though they didn't, you know, have any answers as to why this happened.
I'd love to hear what you guys think happen. Like, I'd love to hear our listeners' theories.
Well, we'll, you know, post on our Instagram and Facebook, so feel free to drop your theories in the comment section. Obviously, please be very respectful, because they do still have living relatives, and there's a lot of people who are heavily invested in this case, so just keep that in mind. But that is all I have for you guys today. Thank you for listening. Sorry this was, you know, kind of a heavier case, but
yeah, they deserve, their story deserves to be out there.
Absolutely. But thank you guys again for listening. We'll have a brand new case for you guys next week, and until then, keep it human.
Bye guys.